This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. And today we are back with a live program. So as always, I'll be taking emails from you. If you have questions for our guest, you could reach out to me at info@alessimd.com. And it gives me great pleasure to have as my guest later on in the show, Dr. Elizabeth Graumisch. Dr. Graumisch is a neuropsychologist at the Mandel Center for Comprehensive Medical Multiple Sclerosis Care at Mount Sinai Rehab Hospital. We're going to be talking about neuropsychology, how it applies not only to patients with multiple sclerosis, but also how we deal with aging, traumatic brain injury. These folks in her profession really provide such valuable information for all of us when treating anything that affects cognition. And as we all know, our population is aging, so the role of neuropsychologists has become much more crucial. I want to take a moment to really thank everybody, all the listeners, for several things. Not only the emails I've been getting, you know, supporting what we're talking about here in this program and this interaction. I'm told our ratings have gone up dramatically in the past year with more and more listeners, not only to the show itself live, but to the podcast itself. And listen, this station, WTIC, clearly there's a political bias to it, right? You could say it's a conservative station or whatever. But I think that the reception we've received on this program really proves the point that good health is not a political issue. It's absolutely not. You don't have to be liberal or conservative. We all want to stay healthy and get good information on how we can stay healthy. And we want to point out the fallacies that are out there. And that's what we've done. And I'm just gratified by everyone and all of your support, where we can show that the listeners here and our group are really making progress in terms of protecting ourselves. Another point to prove that is the fact that vaccine acceptance in Connecticut continues to go up. Interesting. The rest of the country is going down, but in Connecticut, we are seeing one of the highest rates of vaccination of our children than anywhere else in the country. Now, when you hear that and when you see that, that means that we, our listeners and the state of Connecticut, we are a threat. We are a threat to the people who run the Health and Human Services Department, most notably RFK Jr., because he's the anti-vaxxer. And our vaccination rates go up. So therefore, we must be the enemy, even though we pay his salary. So what they are preparing to do is cut our education funds, the funds that we get in Connecticut to educate our children, as a punishment because we do not let people take some willy-nilly approach to vaccination. That means unless you have a legitimate health reason certified by a physician, you are required to get vaccinated before you go to school. None of this personal belief. Again, this is not a personal belief. This is science. It's not religion. because there are no religions, no organized religions, and maybe a backyard religion that you made up, but there are no organized religions that fight against vaccination. So with that, again, we're seeing the positive impact of our program, and I really want to thank all of you for that. Since we're on the topic of vaccination, there's a schedule we follow that we see each year in order to prepare for fall and winter, because that's when we start seeing flu, respiratory syncytial virus, and COVID. So flu, RSV, and COVID. So the process actually begins in February with the CDC, and they have a committee of people who meet regularly, and right around July, they start making recommendations in terms of what we need to avoid. What are we going to do to protect the overwhelming part of our population? And by August, they release these guidelines, right? So the guidelines of who should be getting vaccinated against what will be the eligibility of people, and what will be the policy. So by this time, in August, early August, physicians, pharmacies, and health systems can now order their vaccinations going forward for their employees or for children. Okay, so you have a cycle of how this is done. Then you're able to order it, and by September, right, be ready to start administering these vaccinations to protect people. That has been the system for the past 23 years. But guess what? Not this year. So the ACIP, which is the committee that meets, have all been replaced except for one. There's only one person on there who has any legitimate credentials regarding vaccination. The rest are all anti-vaxxers. And guess what? They've not met yet. So we have no idea who is going to be eligible, if your insurance is going to pay for it, what vaccinations. So the vaccinations have not been ordered. So CVS, Walgreens, UConn, Hartford Healthcare, St. Francis, it's impossible to judge how much you should order and pay for, especially if you're a small physician's office, if you don't know what insurance is going to pay for it or not pay, and who should be getting it and who should not be getting it. So we're in trouble, folks. I don't need to tell you that. And this has just been ongoing. It is confusion at the CDC. There are people who now think, and they have been vilified, the people who work at CDC have been vilified by these anti-vax people to the point where they're shooting at their windows. It is a disgrace. We will keep you informed as these things happen, and especially with respect to how to get vaccinated for this fall, because we all know people over 65, people with chronic illnesses, should be getting these vaccinations. The other thing I wanted to talk a little bit about was meningitis. So meningitis is an inflammation, an infection of the membrane surrounding the brain. It could be two forms, bacterial and viral. The viral form, fairly common much less damaging to the brain itself. Typically presents with neck stiffness, high fever, and a severe headache. But there's the bacterial form of it. Now, the bacterial form of it is much more aggressive and can result in death in a short period of time. It has to be treated immediately or will result in death. And even those who get treated often have long-term effects, hearing loss being the biggest one. Concentration, decrease in concentration, and persistent headaches. There are two vaccines that we have available, the ACWY and the meningitis B vaccine. So in this country, children get the ACWY in most states. There are six states that don't mandate vaccination. But with that, you get the two shots, and the studies have done, I mean, this has been going on since the early 2000s, in a study that looked at children between the ages of 11 and 20 from 2006 to 2010, okay, and then again from 2011 to 2015, we reported a 76% drop in meningitis in children. That's dramatic by any means, 76% drop. But the peak age where we're going to see a problem with meningitis is ages 18 and 19, particularly young people going away to college. And that's why I'm bringing this up, because we're hearing UConn is now back and other schools are now back. People are moving in. They're moving in to live in close quarters. And it's not just college students, people in the military who are in close quarters. And bacterial meningitis is highly infectious from that standpoint. We recommend that people get both the ACWY and the meningitis B vaccine. I've gotten it because of my travels. So adults who are traveling, especially if you're going to sub-Saharan Africa or something of that nature, we use it in the military to protect our troops because, again, it can result in death. So it's important to really look at this. And even the CDC is recommending this. So please be mindful, if you have a child going off to college, that this danger is out there, and it's worth making sure that they have been adequately vaccinated by not just the ACWY, but also the meningitis B vaccine. This day in medicine, August 23rd, 1927, the anarchists Sacco and Vanzetti were executed. And what's interesting about this day in medicine, you might say, well, it's an execution. But there's a Dr. Calvin Goddard. Dr. Goddard lived from 1891 to 1955. And he was the person who was able to identify the ballistics involved in their murders. And he coined the term forensic ballistics. His invention was actually a split-screen microscope. So something that we see it in all these crime shows, right, where they can match up the ballistics with the actual bullet and know exactly what had happened. It's also, he was instrumental in showing the bullet casings in 1929 from the St. Valentine's Day massacre, showing that there were not police weapons involved in that massacre. So he was a cardiologist in practice, but, you know, just grew his curiosity to come up with this term and started a lot of committees in every state. And now it's so common to have the use of forensic ballistics. So on this day, we remember Dr. Calvin Goddard. With that, we're going to take a short break. They're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Elizabeth Gromisch. She is a PhD neuropsychologist. As always, if you have questions for Dr. Gromisch, just reach out to me at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it gives me great pleasure to have as my guest today Dr. Elizabeth Gromisch. Dr. Gromisch is a PhD neuropsychologist. She works at the Mandel Center for Comprehensive Multiple Sclerosis Care at Mount Sinai Rehab Hospital, which is, as you all know, part of Trinity Health of New England. Beth, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You know, we had some time to talk off the air, and I just find what you do fascinating and how it relates to our patients. Can you talk a little bit about, for our listeners, and try to explain what you do? What does a neuropsychologist do?
Sure. So neuropsychology is a specialty of clinical psychology. So what we focus as a neuropsychologist is the relationship between brain and behavior. So we look at different illnesses, injuries, and how they affect the brain and how those result in changes and behavior. So when you're coming in for a clinical neuropsychological examination, and these can be quite long, they can be as short as 2 hours, and they can go 6-8 hours depending on the reason you're coming to see us, we're doing a very detailed evaluation of different cognitive domains. So we're looking at things like your attention, different types of memory, language abilities, visual spatial functioning, and executive functioning. So things like planning, organizing, multitasking. We're coupling this with a clinical interview to get a good sense of your background, your previous medical history, your educational attainment, your childhood, and also looking at other symptoms like mood, sleep, pain. And we're taking a closer look to see what your strengths are as well as your weaknesses. And we're trying to figure out, you know, the changes that maybe you're observing or family members are observing. Are these something due to age or something else? And then we can figure out what's going on, inform your treatment plan, and also come up with recommendations of how to best manage these changes.
How did you get to be a neuropsychologist? In other words, what's the training involved in being a neuropsychologist?
So I am trained first and foremost as a clinical psychologist. So I have my PhD in clinical psychology with health emphasis. I went to Firkhoff Graduate School of Psychology at Yeshiva University in the Bronx. And so I have not only that training in assessment, but also in therapy. I specifically got trained in cognitive behavioral therapy. So that program is, for these, a lot of the PhD and PsyD programs are considered 4+1. So we have those 4 years of classwork, clinical training and research, and that fifth year is a predoctoral clinical internship. So while they are all in clinical psychology, mine had a specialty in neuropsychology. And then after I finished, I graduated my PhD, I did a 2-year specialty fellowship in clinical neuropsychology. Both my internship and fellowship were here in Connecticut at VA Connecticut Healthcare System in West Haven.
Wow, it's a lot of training. What made you want to do this? I mean, was somebody in your family a clinical psychologist? I mean, what I always like to know this from people is what was that motivation when they were thinking of a career?
I always knew I wanted to go into healthcare. So I'm from a family of physicians. My father is a physician, my grandfather, my aunt, my uncle, and now one of my brothers is, as well as many on my husband's side. So, you know, the first one in psychology, but I long had an interest in cognition. And the main reason I went for getting a doctorate in clinical neuropsychology was my mother. She was diagnosed with a rare form of brain cancer when I was in college. So I saw firsthand the effects that a disease can have on someone's brain, changing their way they think, the way they behave. And it made me even more interested in the brain. And then wanting to find out how I could help people, whether it was doing the assessments to figure out what the problem is, and then doing things like education and treatment. You know, I talked a lot about how neuropsychologists play a big role in assessing and finding the cognitive difficulties, but we also play a role in treatment, doing things like cognitive rehabilitation, where we might do different exercises or teach strategies to help compensate for those cognitive difficulties.
We have about a minute before the break, and I would like to just take a step back and talk a little bit about the Mandel Center where you work. So for people who are not familiar with what goes on at the Mandel Center, can you inform everybody?
Sure. So we were founded back in 2008, and we were actually the very first comprehensive MS center in Connecticut, and we received that designation by the National MS Society. So we have three locations. I'm primarily based in Hartford at the Mount Sinai Rehab Hospital, but we also have centers in St. Mary's and Mercy Medical Center. And the idea is that patients can come to one location and get access to all of the services they need. So besides neurology, they can also access rehabilitation, behavioral health, urology, and really with MS, it's a condition that needs a multidisciplinary care approach. And one thing that I really love about the Mandel Center is when we were founded, research was on the forefront. So researchers actually founded before the clinical side. So we're right embedded there in the clinical practice. And what that means is our patients get access to the newest cutting edge research and really can help form the future of MS care.
Okay. And I hope many people, reach out to the Mandel Center, people with multiple sclerosis, for the great work they do. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Elizabeth Gromisch. If you have questions regarding neuropsychology or how it relates to multiple sclerosis, you could reach us at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and my guest today is Dr. Elizabeth Gromisch. And we are talking about the field of neuropsychology. It's interesting, Beth, as you mentioned, a little bit of the history behind the Mandel Center. One of our previous guests before his passing was Peter Wade, who was a trusted colleague of mine and really, I guess, one of the founders at the Mandel Center. And I always remember him very fondly.
Well, I was lucky to be able to work with him for several years.
Oh, really? Okay. Anyhow, let's get right into the idea of neuropsychology and multiple sclerosis, because I don't, you know, in the past we just thought of multiple sclerosis as this purely physical problem affecting the central nervous system, but never really paid much attention to the cognitive effects. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that knowledge came to evolve?
Sure. And, you know, you're absolutely right that mental health issues in MS really weren't paid attention to for many years. It really wasn't until the 1990s that we started to recognize that cognitive issues are quite prevalent in MS. We now know that up to 70% of people have some form of cognitive difficulties. And so that's a huge number of people, especially when we think about in the United States alone, nearly 1 million people live with multiple sclerosis. The kind of cognitive difficulties we see in MS tend to be more mild to moderate. So we're not seeing the kind of cognitive difficulties you would see in like Alzheimer's disease or vascular dementia, but these difficulties are still having a significant impact on people's lives. With MS having an average age of onset of 30, 35, people are starting to have cognitive difficulties when they've just started entering the workforce. So that can have a significant effect on their ability to maintain employment. We also know that cognition can have a negative effect on quality of life, social interactions, and ability to self-manage. The kind of difficulties we see in MS, we see a lot of issues with processing speed that tends to be the hallmark with people having taken them longer to process incoming information. And that difficulty with encoding, that's what really is affecting memory abilities. So both verbal memory and visual spatial memory. The other kind of difficulties we can see are verbal fluency. So coming up with the right words, like on the tip of your tongue, but you can't quite get it out. Executive functioning and visual spatial abilities.
So when people come to you, is it typically because the patient themselves have noticed this cognitive change, or is it their families? How do people, how do they end up seeing you? I mean, granted, it's through the center, but what are people perceiving? If people are out there listening, thinking, geez, maybe I should get an evaluation, what kind of things, especially with patients with MS?
So a lot of times it's the patients themselves that are recognizing something's different. So the way they've described it, you know, the memory part, like I can't remember things like I used to before. Like it's taking me a lot longer to do things, or maybe they're reading and they have to keep rereading the page over and over again before it finally sticks. Another area of cognition we're now paying more attention to in MS is prospective memory, or remembering to remember. So this is the type of memory that if you've ever walked into a room and you're like, why did I come in here?
Yeah.
That's prospective memory. And that is something that does get affected more when we get older. But we recognize that people with MS have more difficulty in that area. And what we have found from our line of research is people remember they need to do something, but they can't remember what. which can be extra frustrating. It's like, I know I need to do something right now, but was it take my medication? Was it pay my bill? Was it to call someone? And so that can have a lot of functional implications. So maybe they're not taking their medication every day like they're supposed to, or maybe they're missing appointments. So those can all be kind of the red flags for people, and then they will ask to come in for an evaluation. Now, in the MS world, there are current recommendations that everyone should be getting an annual screening. So this is an objective brief measurement, less than 20 minutes, so we can track how people are doing over time and pick up pretty early if there are any cognitive difficulties to send on for a further neuropsychological evaluation.
So I got to ask you, so when you have a patient that has this problem with prospective memory, what do you recommend they do? And do smartphones help? I mean, because I hear that from patients all the time, is that, you know, if it weren't for the phone, I'd be in even bigger trouble than I am now. But are there things that you recommend to these patients who have these mild effects? Is it making lists? What do you tell them to do to try and work around this?
Yeah, so with the smartphones, we can think of that as an external memory aid. So those are things that you're relying on outside of yourself to help cue you in. So I'm a big fan of alarms. I set them myself. So setting alarms, taking notes, sticky notes. If you looked at my work computer, I have those digital sticky notes everywhere on my computer, including, like, I show patients when they come in, like, see, this is just my list to make sure I remember everything for our visit today. So those are really helpful. Another thing that can be helpful for prospective memory issues, as well as some other type of cognitive difficulties, are some internal strategies. So things, kind of the skills that you train in to help you remember information. So we actually conducted the very first clinical trial for cognitive rehab and prospective memory in MS that was done via telehealth. And we looked at something called visualization. So that is when you are creating mental images in your mind to remember things you're supposed to do. And we did a very small feasibility study, but what we found is that those visualization strategies do help people. They help them remember to do activities at certain times. And there's a lot of evidence for visualization for other types of memory problems in MS. So that's one of the most robust strategies. And that's something that can be taught. We do worksheets. Our own group is looking at developing a mobile health application that would have those strategies in it, so you can practice it with you have on your phone in the palm of your hand.
So, as you know, we have so many medications now since the early 1990s to really address multiple sclerosis, right? We started with beta interferon and the like, and now we have monoclonal antibodies that we use. Have you been able to quantify changes as people are being treated in terms of, are some of these cognitive changes improving with these treatments overall?
Yeah, so we're seeing more and more of these disease-modifying therapies. They're using cognition as an outcome measure. They typically focus on that processing speed since it's that hallmark in MS. And we are seeing that a number of the disease-modifying therapies can help improve. But one of the things when it comes to cognition, really the area that has the most evidence is the cognitive rehabilitation. We're also finding that exercise can have a really big benefit for improving cognitive functioning. So really approaching it as a whole person approach. You know, we look at taking the disease-modifying therapies as you should, learning some different strategies or doing some training to help promote your cognition, and eating healthy and exercising.
It's so interesting to hear you say that, because we say that on this program all the time. I mean, it's not rocket science, okay? Diet and exercise have to be part of what you do. And so I'm not surprised to hear you say that. But when you look at their processing speed, if it's improving with these medications, how much do you see it improve? I mean, is it, has it been significant? I assume that that's, you know, you have a real objective measure as to whether people are getting better or not, as opposed to the subjectivity overall. But is it a significant change? And when you talk about the rehabilitation stuff, is that kind of the skills you're trying to build into patients?
Yeah, so the cog rehab is those skills. And when we are testing to see if cog rehab is improving, we're also using the same outcome measures. And we do see significant improvements with both of them. But there's a lot of evidence, too, with the cog rehab. And one of the big differences when we could see where the improvements are happening is when we're doing studies with cog rehab, a lot of times it is neuropsychologists like me that are conducting them. So we're able to look at other outcome measures besides the processing speed.
A lot of what you're saying kind of moves part and parcel with age-related changes cognitive changes. How do you tell the difference when you have especially an older patient between what might be age-related versus MS-related?
What I always tell patients when they come in is your raw score means absolutely nothing, because after we do the testing, we always compare your performance to other people, your age, education, and gender when possible. And that's because we do expect as we get older that our cognitive performance isn't going to be the same when we're 18 years old. So that we look at things called normative data, which is large amounts of data collected from healthy adults in different age brackets, accounting for education, gender, and sometimes some other factors, and we can calculate normative scores. A big one we use is Z-scores, and then we can look to see, like, oh, this is where we expect you should be based on your demographics. And then, you know, if it's a little lower than we'd expect it to be, we then take a look at the pathology of it. You know, what is the person's cognitive profile? You know, with MS, we expect them to have difficulties in specific areas. And that looks like a completely different profile than what we'd expect with Alzheimer's disease, with vascular dementia. So that's a big part of the neuropsych evaluation, is really being the detective there and looking at the overall picture and figuring out what's causing this.
So actually, I guess your cognitive testing can be an intricate part of the puzzle in putting together the whole treatment plan for a patient in general. And it's something we've never really thought of. And I don't know that it's really been established outside of centers like your own.
Yeah, what we can gather from a neuropsych evaluation gives us a lot of information. So from the patient's perspective, you know, we can give them skills, identify where their strengths and weaknesses are to help them compensate. It's also going to be a very valuable educational tool to be able to explain to people, you know, why are we seeing what we're seeing? You know, why does MS cause this? Or being able to, you know, show them the difference between, you know, if it's MS or age. But also we can help with treatment plans with our colleagues. So we had two recent cross-sectional studies that we did with our colleagues in physical therapy and found factors like processing speed and depressive symptoms were related to whether or not people are reaching their rehabilitation goals. So we can work together, you know, first by identifying where someone's having difficulty, but collaborating together with giving people strategies or supporting them in their rehab therapies to make sure they're reaching all their goals.
We're talking with Dr. Elizabeth Gromisch, and I want to make sure that I get the information out there. If you or someone is experiencing MS, has been diagnosed with MS, I think today's show really brings to light the fact that it is so important to be treated by a team. And a team of people, and I talk about this with any problem, it's not just one person treating. You really need that team and support. I have a number here I'm looking at, but I don't think it's the correct number. What would be the number for people to reach out to the Mandel Center?
The best number to reach us at, so if you are trying to reach us in Hartford, our number in Hartford is right at the top of my head, I'm thinking of my number. Well, if you want to know about research, our number for research is 860-714-3005. And you can always reach us there if you want to know more about any studies that we have, besides my own in cognition and behavioral health. We have a number in physical health as well. Our clinic number is 860-714-2149.
What's interesting is when I tried to Google it just now, and only the number comes up for the Springfield MS Center. So interesting from that standpoint. Beth, I want to get back to it because, you know, we see a lot of these kind of packaged cognitive tests you can do on your computer, on your phone. You know, in sports, we deal with the impact test, right? And everybody thinks that that's an accurate neuropsychological evaluation, which it is not, nor is it particularly defining in sending someone back after a head injury. But with the advent of these, what is your feeling regarding this type of testing and kind of the computerized technology piece of it?
I think there's a time and place for computerized testing. So I myself am developing a tablet-based cognitive screener for MS that we've been developing with our patients. And there are benefits to it. So for our project on MS Cog Screen, it is more accessible because we're able to reduce the fine motor demands on people and also make it larger. But that's meant to be just a screening. You know, it's just to look to see how they are doing at this moment and determine whether or not they need further evaluation. And while, you know, again, it can be helpful in that aspect, in terms of getting the broader picture of how someone's doing, we get so much more information when you're working with a neuropsychologist, because we don't just look at the actual score. We're also looking at how someone's performing the test. So what is their approach for how they're recalling information? Are they, you know, taking an organized approach, or are they actually pushing their brains a lot harder to get the information in and get it back out? And where that can be really helpful is while their scores may be where we'd expect them to be, if they're maybe more inefficient with how they're processing and retrieving information, that can help provide insights of why they're observing they're having difficulties and lead to better recommendations for strategies or rehab approaches.
You know, one of the things I like that you mentioned is the term of patient stakeholders. Can you talk a little bit about that and talk about your research in particular in working with patients at the Mandel Center?
So patient stakeholders play a really big role in my research. The way that I've approached it is I may be the expert in MS, but they're the experts in their care. So they have that experience of living with MS. They know what it's like day in, day out, what their needs are, and also what's missing from their care. Because that's a big role that research plays, is that we're really there to figure out how we can improve assessments, diagnoses, and treatments, and fill in those gaps. So the work that we have, the two areas that I work on is improving cognitive screenings with our MS Cog Screen project, and the other is developing self-management mobile health applications called Managing My MS My Way. And they're really driven by our patient stakeholders. So with Managing My MS My Way, we started with developing a fatigue self-management program because that's what our patients ask for. And I meet with them and ask them about what strategies have been helpful, what hasn't been helpful. With the technology aspect, is this easy for them to use? What can we do to make it easier for them to integrate into their lives? And I truly see our patient stakeholders as colleagues. That I go to them with ideas and I ask them to be part of the team and really tell me honest opinions, because if I'm going to develop something and you don't like it, then it's not worth doing. So they have taught me so much and they are incredibly valuable members of my team.
You know, it must be tremendously satisfying for a patient. I mean, we talk about clinical research all the time and how important it is to participate in clinical research, but this is certainly a new twist on it where patients actually have some input into it. I would assume your patients find it extremely satisfying to be part of the team.
Yeah, they all the people that I've been lucky to work with on our patient advisory boards have enjoyed it. A number of them have asked to be part of more than one group, which is always heartening for me to see. And it's also great because they have been involved in some of our educational outreach. So for example, you know, we were talking about how mental health issues really haven't been recognized until more recently in MS. And one of the efforts that's been done to improve this is the Consortium of MS Centers sponsors different mental health training programs, which are week-long trainings at different comprehensive centers in the U.S. And we've been lucky to be a site for that. And we have our next cohort coming in September. And we have some of our patient advocates coming to talk with our visiting scholars about their experience living with MS and also what it's like to be part of developing new research programs and what that means for the future of MS care.
Are some of your patient stakeholders not necessarily here in Connecticut physically with you? In other words, do you have people in other parts of the country who are also participating in your projects?
Well, right now, all of our patient stakeholders are based in Connecticut, but we do a lot of our meetings virtually through telehealth. So that way they don't have to make extra trips to our center if they don't need to. But we do try to open up our studies whenever possible to a nationwide. So we had a recent survey a couple months ago now where we wanted to get patients' feedbacks on different cognitive compensatory strategies and what's worked for them, what hasn't. And we made that a national survey so people could participate wherever they were in the U.S.
You know, in closing, Beth, is there something you could share with our listeners that they may not know about? I mean, you presented a lot of stuff they may not know about, but and certainly stuff that I didn't know about. But what does the future look like in terms of MS treatment and treatment of these cognitive changes that we see in multiple sclerosis?
I think MS care is rapidly evolving. We've come so far in the 15 years since I first started doing MS work in grad school. And I really think technology is leading the way. The International Progressive MS Alliance recently had a digital tools workshop in June, which I was lucky to be a presenter at. And it really showed that we can connect more and more people with technology. But what's going to be really crucial is that patients are at the forefront, that they are the ones lending their voice to really drive where the future of MS care is and what their needs are. And really having it be more of a collaborative care model than just telling people this is what you need to do. And that's the same for cognition, that we really have come a long way with recognizing the role of cognitive changes in MS and the effects it can have. And we now can develop so many more tools and interventional approaches that help people. But the way that we're getting there is having patients on our team.
I just want to take time to thank you very much. And for listeners, the Mandel MS Center at Mount Sinai, if you want to reach out, it's 860-714-2149. There's also a center in Springfield, since we have many listeners up that way. Area code 413-452-6570. And in Waterbury, 860-714-2647. If you want more information, also, you could just go to trinityhealthofnewengland.org. Beth, thank you. Thank you for your time today, and thank you for all the wonderful work you do for our patients with multiple sclerosis. Thanks again.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Thanks again to my guest today, Dr. Elizabeth Gromisch. Many thanks to Kevin Corza, who's been on the board. And as always, Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Next week, we'll have some new information, but it will be a taped show. We are starting UConn football, and I will be on the sideline next week. Next up on WTIC is going to be baseball, where the Boston Red Sox take on the New York Yankees. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.